Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I am talking with Patrick Eiber, who is assistant professor of history at the University of Texas at El Paso, though in the fall we'll be starting at the University of Wisconsin, which is actually something we'll get back to a little bit later. And he studies the history of U.S.-Latin American relations and is the author of the book Neither Peace Nor Freedom, The Cultural Cold War in Latin America, published by Harvard University Press. So, Patrick, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So I start with everybody a basic question, and that is just what originally got you interested in studying Latin America?
Yeah, as a regular listener to the podcast, I'm ready for this question. It's a bit circuitous, as it is, I think, for some of your other guests. And it's not exactly a direct line from one place to the other. But when I was in college, I grew up in Iowa and did well in school and so on, and ended up going to Stanford to do my undergraduate work, which I intended to be in math. In fact, my undergraduate degree is in math. But I found the environment there incredibly alienating. And this is not to take anything away from the university, which is obviously a great university, but I was a kid from pretty humble background who had gone to public school and lived in an apartment, small apartments, most of my life, and I was suddenly surrounded by the children of the global elite, for the most part. Right. It was deeply politicizing for me. I mean, it introduced me to a kind of inequality that I didn't know existed. And I had some very influential history professors that began to steer me towards thinking about perhaps moving out of math and into history. And at the same time, I was looking to escape that environment. So I started spending summers living in a former town that was resettled by former FMLN guerrillas in El Salvador, where I would work in the fields in the morning, and in the afternoons I would help the teenagers work on their homework and prepare for college exams. I was basically a volunteer teacher in this small community up in northern rural El Salvador. And I did that for two summers, in a part to get as far away from the kind of climate at Stanford as I could. And the first time I went, I was very enthusiastic. I'd been reading a lot of Noam Chomsky, and I was, you know, really, really impressed by what the FMLN had done. And I'm really glad that I went back for a second summer, because the second time I saw it with slightly different eyes, with more experienced eyes. And I began to see some of the problems that were, you know, that existed in that community, that existed within the party. And this is sort of, I think, those things in combination set me on the path towards these kinds of things that I study, which I didn't end up working on El Salvador or Central America, but, you know, on problems of justice and inequality that have, you know, defined the set of interests that I have going forward. So those are the experiences that really set me on this path.
Yeah, so people have had circuitous routes, but that might set the record, I think, right now. From Stanford to the fields of El Salvador with a math undergraduate degree.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Well, it's something that I needed at the time.
No,
and it meant a lot to me. I didn't mean to. I'm not one of these people who wants to romanticize or, you know, either poverty or Latin America,
right,
or anything like that. It was something that meant a lot to me and still means a lot to me. And I still think about the people that lived in that community that deserved better lives, and the question of, you know, what can be done politically to help them to obtain those lives, is is still, I think, an important question. And you can see that, I suppose, you know, if we transition to talking about the book, you can see that in the history of the left and of the Latin American left that's there in the book.
Yeah, so let's use that then as a segue, because of course your book is about intellectuals who are trying to make their country, their fellow citizens' lives better. And then what you show is that strong states may spend money to get their ideological message out in some way, but the groups taking the money, they might have interests that don't overlap with the state. So can you explain a little bit how that worked in practice in the Cold War?
Sure. So the book is about the cultural Cold War in Latin America. And by the cultural Cold War, we're basically referring to this ideological contest between the Soviet Union and the United States during those years, especially of the first couple of decades of the Cold War, the 1950s and into the 1960s. And, you know, everybody's familiar with competitions like the space race and so on. But there were also organizations for students and for women and for lawyers and then for artists and intellectuals. Both sides had them. They had the Soviet Union had the World Peace Council, which was formed in the late 1940s to promote the message that the West was warmongering and that the Soviet Union was the champion of peace. And in response to this, the CIA began to support the work of many, some of them were ex-communists, some of them were liberal anti-communists, some of them were social democrats, an organization called the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And so they have both of them hold rallies and they do signature campaigns and they publish magazines and they have associated artists producing works of art for them. The communists had the better visual artists. Pablo Picasso painted for them for a while. Diego Rivera, Pablo Neruda was involved in the Latin American setting. And so you have this sort of you have this kind of superpower competition, but that's mediated by these through these groups of artists and intellectuals, who can be a little bit difficult to control. And of course, in the CIA's case, some people know that they're working for a CIA-sponsored organization. Some people figure it out, and some people suspect it, but others seem really not to have known. And so there are magazines put out throughout the world, including in Latin America. What I found in doing the research is that that many times the goals that the states had for these organizations that they were sponsoring were very, very difficult to realize. To take just one example from the book, the people that the Congress for Cultural Freedom, this CIA-sponsored body, are supporting in Latin America tend to have a kind of social democratic politics. They're anti-communist, but they're on the left. And so there were groups like that. There were groups of anti-dictatorial activists, the same kind of people that you'd find in the Caribbean Legion, in the late 40s, trying to overthrow regional dictators, people like Rómulo Betancourt in Venezuela, this type of person, the apristas in Peru. These were all involved with the Congress for Cultural Freedom in Latin America. And so, you know, they supported during the struggle against Batista, they supported Fidel Castro. They smuggled magazines in for him. They did PR work for him. Some of their representatives, you know, people working directly, you know, on the dime of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, doing sort of clandestine work for Fidel Castro. Now, obviously, once he comes into power, within about a year, they're all on the opposite side of things and accusing him of totalitarianism and so on and so forth. And then they reorient the whole operations of the Congress to fight Cuban communism instead of Soviet communism for the 1960s. So there are all these kinds of ironies that they play this real role in helping Castro come to power, and then he becomes their enemy. So it's just more difficult than to say, well, here's the CIA sponsoring this culture over here, sponsoring these political groups, and it has the expected reactionary results because it's the CIA. Sometimes the things that happened were actually quite surprising.
Yeah, and so what lesson I was thinking of this is, to what degree, even now, can intellectuals use their donors for their own purposes?
Well, I think it happens all the time. I mean, there are the donor set is different than it was during the Cold War. I mean, at that time we had these state sponsored groups. They had, the CIA giving money to artists and intellectuals. That kind of thing is probably not happening anymore. I mean, we have some things that you might say are analogous, like the so-called Cuban Twitter that USAID was trying to help create a couple of years ago before it got discovered and exposed. I mean, that sort of falls into the same sort of gray area of civil society supporting clandestine activity that the CIA was handling in this earlier case. So we don't have the same degree of state sponsorship, or at least not in the way that it's perceived. I think that it is the case that artists and intellectuals can try and use funding sources to move their own agendas forward. One of the things that you see back in the Cold War, and I think even today, is people seeking out each other for funding because of ideological affinity, right? Even if the people didn't know that the CIA was behind what it was that they were doing, they knew what the Congress for Cultural Freedom was doing. I mean, they joined it because they shared enough of the politics of that organization. So they weren't confused about the fact that they were involved in an anti-communist front group. They just thought that the money came from the AFL-CIO and the Ford Foundation. Some money did come from the Ford Foundation, but not the CIA. Some of them knew it was the CIA, but some of them didn't. And in fact, the irony is that they would take this argument and they would say, well, we know this money is coming from the labor unions and from the major foundations in the United States, and that proves that is a free society and doesn't have directed and controlled culture the way that the Soviet Union does. And that's a difference that we want, we really want to establish and stand on. So this is a moral difference between these two kinds of systems, except that a lot of that money was secretly CIA money. So it blurs the distinction a little bit.
Right. And then it's interesting too, because if you get found out that you're being paid by the CIA, that's like the kiss of death for legitimacy, even though in fact the money could be used for, if it was money from the AFL-CIO, money from the CIA, it didn't make any difference. They were doing whatever they wanted anyway.
That's right. And so the story of the Congress in Latin America is that they have a fairly ineffective operation during the 1950s. Their magazine at the time was called Cuadernos, and it was considered, even by people internal to the organization, to not be effective. And then in 1965, they shut that one down and launched a new one called Mundo Nuevo, which is much better known and much more famous because it was edited by a man, a very successful editor in his own right, an Uruguayan writer and editor named Emir Rodriguez Monegal, and he had friends, all throughout what we now consider the boom in Latin American letters. So the first issue of Mundo Nuevo, there's an interview with Carlos Fuentes. The second one, there's a chapter of 100 Years of Solitude, Gabriel García Márquez's 100 Years of Solitude, before it had appeared as a novel. And so this magazine is considered to have been culturally significant in a way that its predecessor wasn't. But it's right around that same time that the New York Times and Ramparts Magazine are publishing the revelations of CIA involvement in this whole thing.
Yeah.
And so it's this more, this farther left group that they were sort of cultivating that is most damaged by the CIA revelations. And the older liberal ex-communists, I guess everybody thought they were reactionary by that point anyhow, but the... Right. The more generous social Democrats that came on in the mid-60s are the ones that are most damaged by this.
Right.
So that's another way, the kind of blowback of all these things is another way that the results can be unexpected.
Yeah, because that was actually going to be my next question, which was that you conclude that the influence of intellectuals in Latin America decreased. And so is that essentially the core of the reason why?
Well, I think... My at the end of the book, I'm going to have some analysis that I think that that not just in Latin America but around the world, the moment when intellectuals matter the most is when there's authoritarian politics, and intellectuals can then come to symbolize the frustrated ambitions of people. In ways that they just don't under when there's a democracy. Intellectuals can still stand up for things and perform valuable work and try to inspire through their art or through their essays. And I'm not trying to minimize or negate the role that intellectuals can play within democratic societies, but I don't think they have the same symbolic weight that they do as symbols of resistance during in real authoritarian situations. You know, this could be somebody in the Soviet Union, but it can also be Pablo Neruda in Chile, right? And that gives them enormous moral authority and moral weight, and gives their statements that kind of authority. And so I think that the general view that people have is that intellectuals are less important now than they were during the Cold War. And the funding reflects that. We don't really think that the CIA is giving money for this kind of thing anymore. But it was at that time. That was because it was seen as something that was essential to state security to get intellectuals on your side. Now, who cares?
Right.
Who cares anymore? Well, my argument is that there are ways that we should be very glad that this has happened. That the fact that intellectuals are less attractive to state power is not necessarily a bad thing. That it means that that the politics, the political situation in which they are operating, is less authoritarian.
Right.
And that should be celebrated, even if you're the kind of person who likes the idea of intellectuals having influence over society.
Right. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit, because you and I actually, we met in Lima at the Latin American Studies Association meetings, another person I've sort of met online and then met in person.
Yeah, it's nice. Run into you there.
Yeah, and just chatting about the fact that you got the job at University of Wisconsin, and, you know, you spent, I think, I was looking at your CV, it was 4 years off the tenure track.
Right.
And I know you had talked about that on social media. How did that shape? How does that shape how you look at academia now?
Oh.
Or is that too big a question?
No, I can answer that.
I mean, do you feel cynical? Do you feel hopeful? Do you feel or lucky? You know, like what?
I feel incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
So I spent, as you say, many years working off the tenure track. I spent 2 years in a postdoc, which was a very fine way to spend the first 2 years out of grad school. Then I spent 2 years working as a pretty insecure lecturer and going into every spring thinking that there was a very real possibility that I was going to be unemployed the next year. And it got to the point, I've written about this because there were some personal sort of compounding personal circumstances that happened 3 years ago. My mom passed away very suddenly. I had a couple week old baby at home. And it was just very painful. And I wrote about it, and it was an essay that went viral. It was first published by Inside Higher Ed and then by Slate. They picked it up, and you know, it was read by, I don't know how many thousands of people, but tens, I think perhaps maybe even hundreds of thousands of people. It's a very strange experience to have your personal life become the subject of sort of viral fodder or debate. And what I wanted to be very careful to do there, even though I was in a lot of pain and I don't know how well I did it, but I wanted to make sure to link the personal difficulties that I was having to a broader systemic crisis within higher education. And this is, you know, the move that universities have been making, accelerated by the financial crisis, but predating the financial crisis, to move increasingly towards adjunct labor and contingent faculty, just leaving fewer and fewer permanent tenure track positions to be had. And that was, you know, that affects everybody on the market. It affects, you know, it affects you, the amount of time that it takes to find a job. And then of course, some people never find the job. And I was very close to giving up. It had been so many years, so many times. And at the beginning, I kept telling myself, well, I'll just, you know, there's some missing credential. I'll get the book under contract. I'll get the book done. You know, I'll teach at a public university. I'll do this. I'll do that. And then I'll be qualified and someone will want to hire me. And it just isn't that way. I mean, there just isn't enough work. So you can't control it with your credentials. And eventually I got a job at UTEP, at the University of Texas at El Paso. And there, that was in my fifth year on the market. I had the book from Harvard done. You know, it came out 2 weeks after I started working here at UTEP. And that, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this, but I was a second choice for this job. And that's fine. You know, that's totally fine. But if the person who had the first offer had taken it, then I would have had a book come out with Harvard and I would have had no job. That was my only campus visit that year.
Right.
And so, you know, I had looked for things in journalism and other places. I tried to find other jobs, but you know, this was what I had trained to do and this is what I wanted to do. I was very serious that I wanted to get that book out. And, you know, now the book was out and the reason that I was in Lima was because it won one of Las's book prizes. And I wanted to, you know, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of that, that I finished a book. I finished that book while adjuncting. And, you know, now everything's fine. You know, I like this job and now I'm going to an amazing job at the University of Wisconsin. But I don't think that there should be any kind of story about the inevitability of this or that, you know, this was what would happen all along for me. I know so many people that are still out on the job market with books coming out, with years of experience, who are incredibly talented scholars who can't find jobs. And so it makes me acutely aware that academia is many things, but it is also a system of labor and that we need to support things like unionization campaigns for graduate students and non-tenure track faculty to improve the conditions in this kind of market, which doesn't seem like it's going away anytime soon.
Right. And it also, I think, highlights I think you and I have talked sort of offline about this, was the sausage making of the search process to begin with. Because often the fact that you're the second or the third choice often doesn't have anything to do with the quality of your work or how much people liked you. It's that if there's one single position,
Right.
then some types of criteria have to be used to determine which person gets that. Even I've had searches where we had three people out. We really loved all three.
Sure.
And you can only hire one.
Right. Right. And the other thing that I guess that I would, you know, would like to add to this is that that those of us who are on the lucky side of things now should not construct any kind of narrative around the inevitability of our success.
Sure.
We should be very aware of the contingency of our success and what that means about our obligations to other people within the field. And I guess one of the things that I said at Lhasa was also just to highlight the ways that this is not just a U.S. story right now. It's a story in Europe, but it's also a story in Latin America, where you know, new governments in Argentina and Brazil have dramatically cut back on support for scholarship. That austerity has been written into budgets in a way that's really affecting people's ability to do scholarly work. And my point here is not that we should elevate, you know, the interests of academics above the interests of general society or anything like that, but that we're in very interesting and dangerous political moments in a lot of these countries, and we have a job to do. We have a job to do as scholars. Eric Hobsbawm called historians professional rememberers, and one of the things that we need to do right now is to make sure that certain things about the past are not forgotten, because there are governments in place that would prefer that those things be forgotten. So it seems to me that we should, you know, we have a responsibility, both a professional responsibility and a kind of moral responsibility to try and take those messages out, even as we're aware that the conditions for doing scholarship are getting more difficult, not just in the United States, but in a lot of places.
Yeah, I was thinking too of the that you'd be in a position at a flagship of having a sort of even bigger stage, I would think. But it's interesting to see how, in a very short time ago, you are wondering whether you're going to have a job, and in a relatively short amount of time, then you're like, you're the establishment.
Yeah, I know.
I just kept thinking how it just must be really weird to think about that. Like you are the person who everyone starts criticizing, like, oh, the, you know, these people at flagships. But in fact, you have the full experience that from the bottom to the top.
Right. And I think that is important for me to take to that job.
Right.
Fully aware of how lucky I am to be in that position. And I'd like to think that I would be aware of how lucky I was, even if I hadn't gone through those difficult years. But maybe I'm deluding myself about that. But certainly having gone through it, I am deeply appreciative of the opportunities, and not just the one that's coming at the University of Wisconsin, but also the one here at UTEP, which is
sure.
a great place to work. And it has amazing students, and about half of them are first generation college students. So you're really working to help your students achieve some kind of social mobility. That's really important work. You know, when I go to Wisconsin, one of the first things I'm going to do is locate the first generation and low income student group on that campus, and try and support that population there. It won't be as big as it is here
right.
at UTEP, but it's still there. And those people are still there. And I needed that support when I was in college and didn't get it. And I partly have the career that I have now because of that. But now that I'm in a position of real and very genuine privilege, I've got to use it. I'm going to use it as well as I can to do as much good for people and for people in the field as I'm capable of doing.
Right. Well, I think that's a nice place to end. And indeed, we're out of time anyway. I've been talking with Patrick Eiber, who is assistant professor of history at the University of Texas in El Paso. In the fall, will be at the University of Wisconsin. So again, Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's been great.